In this episode, we are going to be talking about the 1949 classic film, The Third Man, which starred Joseph Cotten, Orson Welles, Alida Valli. It was directed by Carol Reed from a screenplay by Graham Greene. My guest today is film critic Eric Marchin. I want to welcome him back. He was on recently to talk about The Night of the Hunter, which is a great noir with Robert Mitchum. He is the host of Cinema Scene on Rogers Television, and he has a great podcast that he co-hosts called the Untitled Movie Podcast. Eric, welcome back.
Robert, thank you so much for having me. I realize that we've already, we've already failed, so to speak, because we're only two men having this conversation. There should be a third man.
Before we jump into the film, I'm not sure how disputed this is on whether it's a noir or not. I'm curious, do you feel this is a noir? And if so, why do you think it is? And if not, then why is it not?
Yeah, you know what? I was thinking about this as well, because the last time, you know, we had the conversation about The Night of the Hunter, there are definite noir elements in that movie. And this is also very similar, where, you know, you have a character who's kind of put into a situation that's a, you know, investigation, and it kind of leads to right. some dark tunnels and sewer systems in this case. But it's also a little bit more sort of abstract in its depiction of classifying it as a film noir, because it takes place in post-World War II Europe, and right. it also is referencing the Western as well. You have a lead character who is a Western writer who is basically taking the law into his own hands like a vigilante, and, you know, at that same time he kind of falls in love with a quote-unquote femme fatale, mm-hmm. but it almost feels like it's kind of leading up to this big showdown. So there's elements of the Western and film noir in this, but also post-World War II Vienna, which I think is also something really fascinating, because when you think of film noir, a lot of it takes place in sort of, you know, seedy back rooms and, you know, yeah. office spaces and, you know, abandoned factories and things like this, where a lot of it is in sort of wide open spaces on city streets at night, mm-hmm. or, you know, in sort of buildings that have crumbled or have been sort of damaged by, you know, the fallout of war. So I do think ultimately it kind of lends itself to the film noir genre, but I don't know if it's necessarily a straight film noir, but it is melancholy and ultimately, you know, ends on a depressing note. And I think that also kind of puts it in that category of film noir, but it is one to talk about in sort of its categorization, because a lot of people, when it first came out, it was a hit, but at the same time, it was a movie that was kind of relegated as just being a thriller, you know, something right. that was a pulpy B movie, which is also kind of fitting because, you know, Holly Martins, the main character played by Joseph Cotten's, is, you know, considered this right. pulpy Western writer, and, you know, isn't considered a great author. And, you know, over the decades, this film has been sort of reappraised. And I know that you have talked about, you know, Hitchcock and Truffaut and those conversations where, you know, Truffaut was one of those guys at the, you know, with the Cahiers du Cinéma who reappraised Hitchcock's film right. career and looked at his movies more than just entertainment as, you know, great art. And I feel that The Third Man has benefited from people like Roger Ebert over, you know, the decades, being the voice to say that, oh, this, you know, is not just, you know, an entertainment. It is an entertainment, but it's also a great movie.
No, very well said. And, you know, it's interesting that you say that, because when it came out, you're right. I mean, it was, you know, people at that time would have said, well, it's a thriller, or a lot of noirs were, you know, under the genre banner of melodrama or crime film or pulpy. And this film certainly has all of those elements. And yeah, I mean, it's true. I mean, the innocent man who gets caught up in a situation he doesn't want to be into, who's ultimately good, but has his share of flaws. You know, Joseph Cotten is someone who's up against a choice whether or not he's going to save his friend Harry, who he finds out is basically a murderer with this black market ring with the penicillin that him and his cronies basically were handing out to hospitals because they were short on penicillin at that time. And, you know, he has to make a choice. Am I going to help the police get him? Because sure enough, it was, you know, Harry was already going to meet him at a certain point or not. And he's quite torn. And actually, he really decides not to do it. It's only when the police bring him to go see what happened to a lot of the children who, you know, got gangrene, or they went, like, they either died or they, you know, went insane. They're in mental wards and stuff like that. And, you know, so again, there's no black and white. There's a lot of grays. He's also, I think they were going to make it more obvious that he was an alcoholic. I mean, you see him drunk in certain scenes. So I didn't think he necessarily was an alcoholic. I felt that was problematic, but I thought maybe because of the, you know, when he gets there, he finds out his friend is dead. Later on, he finds out his friend's a killer. So, you know, I mean, you don't have to be an alcoholic to want to escape something that's bad and take a drink, you know?
No, it's not like The Lost Weekend, where exactly. It's very apparent that this is a character study on somebody, you know, struggling with addiction, where like it's almost a common trope where, you know, writer characters are drinkers in general because it's a lonely right. profession.
Right.
And even more so, like the whole sort of structure of this narrative, you know, going back to the film noir aspect, is that it is sort of a murder mystery to begin with, because when, you know, Holly first comes to Vienna, he's promised a job from Harry, and
right.
Harry doesn't show up at the train station at the American section. That's an important thing also to mention, is that Vienna in post-World War II is divided into these sections with the Americans, the British, the French, and the Russian,
right.
none
right.
of which are working together in any right. capacity whatsoever. And so he gets there. Harry's not around. He then finds out shortly after that Harry was killed in a car accident. He was run over. And you find out that Holly Martins, again, is a character who's his own worst enemy at times, where he likes to kind of not only take the law into his own hands, but he doesn't really care for authority. And we see that kind of
right,
relationship
yes.
unfold between him and the major, Major Calloway,
yeah.
played by Trevor Howard. And that's also another thing that will come up a lot throughout this, is that everybody kind of either intentionally or does it subconsciously in a Freudian slip, mispronounces names, you know.
Because
Calloway
saying,
he calls right. him deliberately Callahan.
Yeah, Callahan. Irish, yeah.
And then on top of that, you have Dr. Vink, who's called Dr. Wink, and he always
right.
corrects Holly. And
right.
then you have Anna Schmidt, who is calling Holly Harry at times. So, you know, there's this weird kind of, you know, whether it's intentional or not, I think it is obviously intentional with the major, but
the hostilities amongst all the different ethnicities. Yeah.
Yeah, so exactly.
It's true. Yeah, it didn't pop out to me as much as you mentioned, but now that you mention it, it's actually much more obvious. Yeah.
Yeah. And then on top of that, you have, you know, this, I think the two things that really stick out in this movie, you know, whether it be the first time you watch it or the 10th time you watch it, is sort of the lack of collaboration between the sections. And that actually weirdly reminded me, because I rewatched it not too long ago, of Zodiac, where you have all these police precincts not working together
right.
and everybody kind of leaving everybody else in the dark in terms of, you know, giving evidence or facts or collaboration to catch the Zodiac killer. And here it's the same thing with Harry Lime, where I wonder if Harry is as slippery as or as cunning as he is portrayed, or if he sort of benefits from, you know, all these government bodies not kind of actually sort of putting aside their differences in order to capture this guy. And then the other thing that obviously sticks out is the score. I think Anton Harris's score
so good.
Juxtaposes sort of the dark kind of morbid quality of what's going on. And it's very jaunty. But weirdly, what I was thinking about while watching it is like, this is a score that would work perfectly in a sort of, you know, comedy movie that takes place in Honolulu or something like that. Like nowadays, when you hear that, you feel like, you know, the zither, which is sort of the main instrument, and you see it at the beginning of the movie, the strings.
Yeah, I love that. At first I was like, what is that? Then I'm like, oh yes, you can see the strings strumming. Yeah.
You also think of like tiki music that would be used in something like, you know, SpongeBob SquarePants. I can't believe I'm making the connection between the third man and SpongeBob, but it kind of has that quality of where like it has this sort of fast-paced action to it, and you know, like the characters as they're moving along or sort of roaming around Vienna, it sort of adds a quality of suspense, but it's also weirdly entertaining.
Yeah, it's an interesting choice because there are times where it added a real stress to the situations and to the scenes, and I'm always fascinated when composers are found, whether they came to the project or the director chose the composer, that it's such a contrast to what's going on, yet fits the film so perfectly. And it's hard to figure out why that is, other than perhaps it has a European feel to it as well. But it's one of the greatest scores. I mean, this is probably only my third viewing of this, and that's always one of the things that I remember the most. And I think a lot of people probably remember that as well, is this brilliant score. But another character that I was really fascinated by is Anna Schmidt, played by Alida Valli. Again, a question of one's own morals. You know, she's has this affair with Harry Lime, and she's totally in love with him. And later on, when she finds out that he was basically a murderer, and
he's a war criminal. Yeah.
He's a war criminal. And she basically admits that she knew there was something dicey, but she didn't realize that he was this awful, you know. And even then, when she has a chance also towards the end to help Harry, Joseph Cotton as Holly, get him. And she wants to save him. I mean, her feelings clouded her judgment. So what does that say, you know, about her? And you know, it's also interesting that Joseph Cotton falls in love with her. And there's this scene that, to me, this is maybe something, I wonder if this is something that's less talked about with this film. But one of the most fascinating scenes to me is when he comes and tells her the truth about Harry and he's drunk. And then he begins to come on to her and he begins to flirt with her. And you see that he has feelings for her, but he does it at the worst time, at the most inappropriate time. And she's crying and he, you know, she laughs at him at first. You wonder if she's amused by him or just trying to, you know, make light of the fact that he's basically, you know, saying that, he was in love with her. But then he keeps going. You see her crying and he says, you know, I wouldn't have a chance with you, would I? He doesn't comfort her. He doesn't say, you know, everything's going to be okay. Something along those lines. He just flirts with her at the worst time. And it was one of the most uncomfortable scenes. I don't know how you felt about that scene.
Yeah, I think going back first just talking about sort of the morals of the characters, I think that's interesting because what it says not only about them, but I think it says a lot about Harry again.
Right.
You know, again, quoting a Hitchcock title, the trouble with Harry is that he's a charming sociopath and he has the people in his life under his thumb.
As they often are charming.
Yeah, to the point where when they find out even about, you know, him diluting penicillin and selling it on the black market to people in need and, you know, many of which are dying, and he makes a tax-free profit, you think to yourself, okay, well, what is it about this guy that has these people so enamored, so loyal to a T? And then later on, when we see Orson Welles, which isn't until much later into the movie, which is a great reveal and obviously a very iconic one, you start to realize the charm of this sociopath. And, you know, there's a great Ferris wheel sequence as well, where that conversation between Joseph Cotton and Wells continues, and both of which were kind of part of the same theater rep and sort of, you know, had worked together many, many times before, including including Citizen Kane. And so I think that that's kind of fascinating in itself. And then to your point, this is something I've been thinking about a lot with both of the watches I've done of this movie recently. I don't know if it is necessarily a love story on the part of Holly. I almost feel there's a...
No, not at all.
There's a moment where Holly talks about living vicariously through Harry and having a friendship over 20 years that he kind of envied him. And I almost feel that there are times where he's trying to either one up Harry or just try to be Harry, to the point where he's trying to assume, you know, his past relationships with other people and love life and stuff like that. And there's also another really great little moment that I didn't clue into the first time I rewatched this not too long ago, was Anna is a actor in theater productions, and she says to Holly that she doesn't do tragedies. She only does comedies. But I found that kind of insightful and interesting because the film itself is a tragedy.
Yeah, it's such a great irony, right? And she doesn't even smile, like when he makes her laugh, and that scene is the only time you see her laugh or smile. But yet when she's doing these plays, she's only smiling. She's only putting on this performance, yet at the same time, she's involved with something that is so dark. That's an interesting point on Holly, that maybe his feelings towards Anna were more because he envied Orson Welles, you know, Orson Welles's Harry so much, in terms of wanting to live vicariously through him. Because I agree, I never thought that there was any kind of love story between them. And that is certainly confirmed at the end, and particularly that great shot where he's waiting for her after the funeral. She, you know, is slowly coming down that long driveway and passes right by him. And you wonder, is this going to go the cliche conventional route where they, you know, there's some kind of happy ending. And I love that it doesn't, you know, cause there was nothing between them. And she, you know, she felt betrayed and angry that he killed him and that he put him in a position to get caught and didn't try to let him get away like she did. And I couldn't help but think of, as soon as I saw this, I'd never caught it before, but that is the identical shot of at the end of The Departed. I'm not sure if you know what I'm referring to, but when Matt Damon and Vera
Farmiga,
Farmiga, that's right, after the funeral of DiCaprio, the exact same thing. You know, he's trying to make up with her and she just walks directly to the camera. And as we said before we started recording, Scorsese, he's a big fan of this film and got a B+ on his
on his film school essay.
Because his teacher Mnuchin, I believe, said this is only a thriller, because, you know, Mnuchin came from, he was really interested in very personal, you know, documentary style filmmaking. Not that this isn't, but I think he dismissed it. Obviously, Scorsese can see a lot more in it, some of the things that we're discussing, which...
Well, genre is dismissed in general. And exactly, we talked about this before on The Night of the Hunter, where, like, again, even reading... If you read Roger Ebert's great essay book on both this movie and also The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, it's fascinating because the first time that Roger Ebert watched The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, he loved the film, but he only gave it 3 out of 4 stars. And his reasoning back then was because no matter how good of a movie it was still a Western, and Westerns couldn't have masterpieces.
Right.
He since grew up and changed his mind, obviously, but he had always had kind of a problem with genre movies, especially with horror films as well, where he would always kind of look down upon them and take kind of a moral standing. But it was just fascinating, you know, looking at how genre at that period was mostly disposable entertainment in the 30s into the 40s and even into the 50s, where you had to get someone like Francis, you know, like Truffaut to kind of come in and be like, no. These movies have as much artistic value as any of the mainstream Oscar winners or things like that. And so, you know, you think about that, and that is a great point that you made with The Departed. It's just fascinating thinking of that final shot also being something one of many things that Carol Reed basically had to fight for with producer David O. Selznick, because David O. Selznick wanted to shoot the film in London on sets, and Carol Reed wanted to shoot the movie on location. And to your point,
that really adds to it. That was a brilliant choice, which makes it feel more noir with the on-set locations. You know, the grounds of Vienna, you can, like, they're wet. You can just, it added to the decaying, you know, environment because of the war, you know, because of what had just happened.
Yeah. And it's very slick looking that way, but it's also, I mean, you know, it's not a documentary, but it is documenting that period in post-World War II Vienna. So you can watch this movie and look back and say, okay, well, this is kind of what, you know, a war-torn country looks like after the results of, you know, unspeakable atrocities. And so that alone, like, again, you know, I don't think time travel will ever be invented. The closest thing we have to it are movies.
Right.
And watching something like this gives you that experience to know kind of what maybe that looked like a little bit. And then, you know, another important element of this movie is kind of the final staging of the Vienna sewer system that is also very intricate and sort of hard to navigate, to the point where they actually had to bring in local police to kind of help sort of navigate that. And Orson Welles did not want to go into the sewers because he was afraid of contracting some sort of disease.
Yeah, I just read that. So everything he did was in a studio?
Yes, it was on a soundstage in London.
I mean, it looks like he's in a sewer.
Yeah, you know, I mean, well, even really to the good. Even to the point where you see, you know, his fingers coming out of the sewer grate at that one scene. That's actually Carol Reed's fingers coming out of the grate. But yeah, and to your point, like, going back to, like, Harry Lime, for me, I think is one of the greatest villains in cinematic history because he's such a complex character, and the way that he sort of holds himself up, he's not your classic dastardly villain. He's a guy that is an opportunist.
Right.
He is very charming. Like, you understand why people who may be either weak-willed or are looking for somebody to kind of emulate or, you know, work with would kind of succumb to those charms. And the way that he talks about people on the Ferris wheel as dots is so disturbing and it's hard to shake that scene. And yet he still is able to kind of manipulate Holly in that moment, talking about, like, how, you know, during the Borgias in Italy during that 30 years afterwards produced, you know, Michelangelo and Da Vinci and the Renaissance. And then, you know, Sweden, which is a, you know, very neutral country, only produced the cuckoo clock. And it's such a great kind of diss.
Memorable. And Wells wrote that little speech.
Yeah. And then there's also this weird kind of comedic moment in the film that I think works really well, where he's offered a chance to speak to, fellow sort of book lovers and sort of give the American perspective on things. And the way that that plays out almost feels like, you know, it's the end of Holly in a weird way, but the way that it kind of plays is almost like this weird comedic punchline.
Yeah, that was done so well, because and I think the audience, at least my experience, was that you forget that he was there with no money, and the job, quote unquote job, with Harry is gone, because Harry is, as they told him, as he thinks, is dead. And then he gets into the situation where he's going to be, like, hosting and doing a Q&A at this book event, and they're the ones paying for his accommodation. I actually like that they took care of those little details, like, well, because, you know, it's he talks about how he's broke, and so they're paying for his, you know, the flat he's in and stuff like that. And when he goes in that cab, you very much think he's going to be killed, because all those people he's been investigating on his own, everyone's becoming suspicious of him.
He's been framed for murder with the porter who's in Harry's old apartment. So
Stuff like that. And you forget all about this book club. And then sure enough, it's like, oh yes, here he is for our host for the night. And it's interesting because he obviously was not prepared. He was in distress. That one guy shows up and is even watching him. And you see all those people leaving. And I think that added to the fact that, as you said, this is just the end of Harry, because it makes you think that the story is just going to go up with him trying to get killed all the way to the end, you know, but then it comes with this twist that, oh no, Harry is still alive, you know? So it's ambiguous because you don't know whether they were trying to kill Harry, Holly, Joseph Cotton's character, or were they just watching him, and maybe Wells was hoping that he could get him on board with what they were doing. I don't know what you I mean it's apparent at the end he was gonna try to kill Cotton, but
yeah,
you don't you don't see those decisions.
Yeah, I think when it comes to Harry, I think as long as it benefits him, it doesn't matter. So whether or not Holly is killed or whether or not Holly is converted over to his side of things, as long as he's not arrested or apprehended or revealed that he's still alive, because basically, you know, Harry is a sociopath and is only looking out for himself.
Right.
So, you know, it doesn't matter whether or not Holly, you know, is convinced of that or not. It's just, you know, he's looking out for number one, and there's that self-centered quality there. And again, I think the voice of reason throughout this entire movie is Trevor Howard's character. I really like the dynamic between him and Joseph Cotton and the way that they kind of, you know, spar, but at the same time, there's that kind of British politeness, but also, you know, a sense of like, listen, man, you're in over your head. You don't know all the facts. I need to sit you down and tell you what your friend's been doing and how horrible a person he is. And even when Holly's is just so adamantly, you know, petty, you know, and sort of trying to prove that this major is wrong, Trevor Howard is just so, you know, kind and weirdly, again, you know, the one that's like, maybe you should leave. Maybe you should just go home. I will supply you with a plane ticket. You know, just get out of here.
And I love the other cop with him who was like, had to punch him in once. He was also his biggest fan of his books. But yeah, there's certainly a lot about Harry that is mysterious. And I certainly agree that his charm is what attracts these people to him. And you also wonder, where did he stray? Because they were friends for so long, him and Joseph Cotton's character, Holly. And at the same time, he says to him in the Ferris wheel, I thought you believe in God. I thought, you know, you get the impression he was a better person at one point. And the only thing I could think of is it was the result of the war. I mean, and that's a very noir thing, that because of the war, a lot of men unfortunately came out cynical, hardened, and money became the utmost motivator above all, you know, that they'll do anything for money. And even, you know, as you said, he's comparing people on all the way on the ground when they're on the Ferris wheel to just dots, and that people are better off dead. And he compares it to what politicians kill people. He tries to justify it up and down. So it makes you wonder, has he just been a sociopath all along and now he's just deteriorating? Or was there some kind of direct experience in the war? You don't know. So there's lots to, I don't think they've mentioned that he was in anything with him at the war. I don't think so.
No, they do talk about how Cotton and Wells's characters, you know, over the 20 years that they've known each other, Wells has always kind of been one of those guys that can get things done or find the things that you want, and was kind of one of those very, again, charming, sophisticated types who's a middleman.
Right.
And I almost feel like maybe he wasn't diabolical, and even to his thinking now, he probably didn't think of himself as being, you know, a monster, which he is, in sort of, you know, what he was doing with the penicillin. But you always feel that, like, you know, someone like that has those traits, and maybe it just needed a little push, and that push was World War II, and seeing that you know, his character is also a survivor, but he wants to survive comfortably. And to do so, he found his avenue of opportunity. And that avenue of opportunity was to sell diluted penicillin to people in need, and ultimately, you know, either killing them or having them go mad. And maybe it was on a microcosm in, you know, his time in the US or other parts of the world where he was, you know, taking advantage of people, but he's still a con man. And I still think that that's still apparent in the relationship that Holly had with Harry. And, you know, again, I think Holly is more fascinating in the sense of why would he stick around with him for 20 years, you know, being friends with him, where, you know, Anna's relationship hasn't been as long. So it kind of goes to show you that, like, even in the end, he's kind of flipping back and forth between should I betray my friend or, right, you know, should I ultimately help him? And even, you know, when you don't see Holly shoot Harry, but when you kind of see that moment of them kind of looking at each other,
right,
it almost feels more of a mercy that Holly kills Harry, that he realizes, well, you know, he even says, I don't want to be the one that ties the noose if you're going to hang him when you catch him. So it almost feels like he's doing him a favor instead of, you know, just killing him out of, you know, revenge or spite or something like that.
Yeah, I love that moment too. You know, like I said, it's been a number of years since I've seen it before last night. And there's always those iconic moments, which I remember. You know, it's the Ferris wheel scene, it's the music, and it's that ending in particular, because they just hang and the way they're looking at each other, and he's, you know, they both have guns, and you see Wells nod as if to say, you know, go ahead, do away with me. And I love how it's just that close up just holds on Cotton beautifully as he's trying to decide what it is to do. What is, you know, and you hear the police officer scream out, you know, if you see him, shoot him. And it's such a beautiful moment. And to me, it really brings out the essence of the story for me, which was you never truly can know anyone, you know, and that suddenly your best friend can be a sociopath in this case, right? So I just love that. I thought it was so emotional. And I love that you don't know who shot who at first, because, you know, you hear the bang and then you just see someone in the shadows. And it's possible that Wells turned the gun on him. And then at the funeral, finally, you have a sigh of relief that it's Cotton is not the one who died. He's at the funeral, but not in the coffin. Right. So I love that.
But then again, to your point, there's something really interesting there. It's like, who really, you know, benefited in the situation, the person that was killed or the person who continues to live? Because right, the person who's right, continuing to live is basically a shell of himself, you know, and what's he going to do once he gets back to the US? He's broke. He doesn't have a job. Right. To your point, there are still hints of him being, you know, an alcoholic, or at least maybe indulging right, a little too much in alcohol. Right. So ultimately it's like, well, Harry, even though he is now dead, lived a life that was for him very fulfilling, you know, and to the point where, you know, he needed to be taken down, where now, you know, Cotton's character is just kind of going to probably drift through the next, you know, 10, 20 years of his life. And whether or not he dies of, you know, alcohol poisoning or just becomes, you know, a very bitter writer in the process and you know, turns out even more sort of, you know, B Western stories, that is something as well that I keep thinking of, where it's like, ultimately who benefits in the end, because it's really nobody. And that also leads to the film noir aspect of it all. But again, I really love that sewer sequence, and watching that, there's a moment where you see some of the police kind of, you know, climbing down on a rope where the waterfall is. And that sequence looks so modern. Like, it doesn't look like a film that was shot in 1949. It looks like a movie that could be made today. Yeah. And I think, again, shooting on location benefits immensely.
No, that was such a smart move. The director insisted on that. And he has those angles sometimes that are just like tilted. They're just like there. And it added to this feeling of uneasiness and nervousness. And I believe he showed it to, I think it was Wyler,
William Wyler, who gave him like a split level. And that's something I think as well that's important to, and I'm so glad you brought that up because I completely forgot about it and I don't know why. Partly is I'm not the biggest fan of Dutch or oblique angles in movies because I feel that they're done to death. As soon as I saw them in Sir Kenneth Branagh's Thor, I was like, okay, the two things in movies that I think used to have so much meaning that don't anymore are those angles and also the close-up, where they're just used very sparingly and they don't have the same meaning that they used to, where like you look at the close-up of when Harry is revealed, you know, when the light hits his face, that means something. That's saying something about the character, not only revealing that he's still alive, but how, you know, again, smug he is in that moment of where he's not really afraid that he's been revealed.
Well, that's what's so interesting. An inconvenience.
Going back to sort of those Dutch angles, what I love about them in this movie is that they work because it is a genre piece and there is an unease to it all where, you know, characters are having these conversations where on the surface they seem banal, but ultimately underneath there's something much more sinister being either suggested or sort of contemplated with the characters trying to piece together what is going on in the moment. And I think that really does add to the suspense. And I mean, Carol Reed did get an Oscar nomination for directing the film. And those angles have been sort of used multiple times in other films, in thrillers and horror movies, similar with like the split diopter. So, you know, I think when it comes to this film using it in the context and how it's using it, it works perfectly. But I could also say at the time and when it's made, it's something new. And when it's something brand is new.
Yeah.
It's going chaotic. To be criticized, you know, it's going to be criticized because we don't want something that is different or, you know, trying to push the boundaries of what the cinematic language can be, you know, and I understand where an audience member is thinking like, oh, well, why are these two people who are just sitting down having a conversation looking like they're about to like, you know, fall off the frame? And you know, we haven't really talked much about, you know, author Graham Greene writing this thing and you know, his sort of process in that he worked very much with Carol Reed in sort of making it a more sort of downbeat and depressing film, because any opportunity there was to maybe show some humanity or optimism, both Green and Reed agreed that that wasn't what this movie was about.
Absolutely.
And I think, you know, them sort
that would have ruined it.
Yeah, being stubborn and sort of talking to David O. Selznick and saying like, look, I know you're a Hollywood, you know, studio head and you're trying to sell a movie and get people in the seats, but this isn't that kind of film.
Even this relationship with Anna, I find interesting because he acts like he doesn't care about her when, you know, on the Ferris wheel where he says, oh, you know, they arrested her, and he laughs it off. But then I love, you know, that he writes her name in the window with the heart around it. And even the fact that he's outside the apartment when Joseph Cotten and Anna are, you know, upstairs, is he there because he's watching Joseph Cotten, or is he there just to be close, to just to watch her, you know, through the window, like, because he misses her? And there's that element with the cat too, that the cat only loved him. I love that, you know, and then sure enough, this cat goes towards the foot. I mean, it works beautifully. So there's a lot to consider there, and we see them in the same frame for literally 5 seconds, but there's a whole relationship in this film that is only discussed, which makes it mysterious and interesting for me. I don't know how you felt about the two of them together.
Yeah, I think it's kind of interesting that you mentioned, you know, him kind of watching her from afar. And again, I don't know if it's necessarily love, because I don't know if Harry can actually love anybody. I think it's almost a sense of territorial kind of animalistic kind of, you know, feelings and jealousy, and that, you know, Harry feels that maybe Holly is sort of, you know, infringing on his territory in a way that he, you know, is in a place where, you know, Harry is the boss and Harry should, you know, always be the boss, whether it's in life or death. And, you know, and there's this,
that's again, interesting. This weird ownership
towards everything. And again, the thing I like the most about Harry in terms of the lighting of the movies, anytime the light is on him, he seems to be the most vulnerable in the light, where you know, you see him enter that cafe through the back entrance at the end of the film. And to your point, mentioning, you know, the only time you see them, you know, Anna and him together in a scene, she says that, oh, you're basically, you know, working as a police informant. And that kind of tips Harry off to the ultimate sort of final chase sequence in the sewers.
Right.
But watching Wells's face react to that moment, being like, oh, I'm in a situation here. And that's the only time where you ever see him kind of
slip. Yeah.
Feel
the mask
like
comes off.
Exactly. And he's not worried about Anna. He's not worried about Holly. He's worried about himself, you know, between this and The Night of the Hunter. I mean, these are two great movies. And if you have the chance to, you know, pick them up on Blu-ray, I know the Third Man's not available on Criterion anymore. But if you're in Canada, it is on iTunes. I think that there is a Studio Canal Blu-ray version that they released not too long ago. I'm not sure if it has been discontinued yet, but you can check on Blu-ray.com. Again, it's just a great movie. And I hope, you know, more people look at it as not just academic work.
Right.
You know, it's just a great kind of
entertainment,
but also there's so much there.
It works on so many levels.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's the thing, when I'm sure you've come to have that conversation with many people when you're sort of recommending films or talking about movies, where, like, you know, there's an academic quality to this, but at the same time, there's just something so joyful about watching, you know, a masterful movie and learning where a lot of influence came from.
Yeah, no, very well said. Very well said. No, I'm glad I saw it again, and I'm glad that we reviewed this great noir right before the month of November, which we call Noirvember. So I'm sure there's going to be a lot of people doing noirs. I want to thank everyone who is a patron of mine on Patreon. I actually have a film noir tier, a tier dedicated to film noir bonus content created by me. You go to patreon.com/RobertBellissimo at the movies to become a member. There's also an audio version of this podcast, which is available on all the platforms that are out there. Not all the episodes from the YouTube channel are on the audio one. So head over to the YouTube channel when you're at home to see more. And if you're on the go, feel free to listen as well on the audio version. And where can people find, what's the easiest place to find your podcast and your The Rogers show?
Yeah.
Is that also online, Eric?
It is, yes. So you can find my video reviews on rogerstv.com/cinemascene. I'm on the social medias at EM6211, and Untitled Movie Podcast is also on Twitter and under Untitled Movie Podcast.
Great. Perfect. And I'll leave those links in the description box below if you want to get in touch with Eric and listen to his podcast or watch his show on Rogers. And just lastly, if this is your first time here, please consider subscribing to my channel. It's absolutely free. My channel is dedicated to exploring storytelling on film from movies from all over the world. Just click on the Robert Bellissimo at the Movies logo. You'll see it right here floating above my head to your top left in just a second. Just click on that and then click the bell in order to get a notification every time I release a new video or when I do go live. Thank you again, everyone. We'll see you in the next episode.